You're listening to WWBC Cocoa, Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Cocoa, Rockledge, and W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, and 100.7 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida. We are heard on AM 1510, WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and all over God's magnificent planet.
That's right. On 1510, WWBC.com, you can hit that listen live button and get us on any one of your streaming devices. Of course, we also archive all of the shows there under the On Demand button. You can pick any Monday and see Viewpoint with Sita and Friends and get the download from there. Of course, on our pages and our social media and our website, SitaMediaInc.com, we make sure that we put our pictures and little bio and everything to make sure that the guests get as much notoriety as they've gotten lately. And, you know, and because of that, we get anywhere from 15, well, actually, it's more like 16,000 to 18,000 downloads a week still, Sita. So it's been a fantastic opportunity for not just for us, for the show, to promote community radio, but certainly for all of the guests that have been on. So it's been great. And once again, Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Well, for our listeners who are tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends today, this is January, gosh, 2026. I can't believe the month is almost ending, right? But just a quick recap about our show. Our show is fun, it's interesting, educational, and today's show is going to be quite exciting if you ask me, and it's fun. We speak here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We know that freedom of speech comes with a responsibility, and we are very responsible. We speak to people who want to chat about financial literacy, folks who wrote a book, people who want to talk about their book, maybe get someone to listen and purchase that book. We also speak with people who are advocates for the elderly, for nonviolence, to vote, clean air, clean water, clean, you know, great sunshine, like the guy who calls in to talk about solar energy. Whatever it is, we give you a platform, lots of nonprofits, a lot of people doing great things, sustainability on God's planet. Whatever it is, as we get older, bolder, and wiser, we all understand that it is our inherent right to leave our planet a better place than we found it. And we do try on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And I am Sita Begee, and you have Ellen O'Neill, my co-host, is here, and Ali Tambor. Danny's joining our board. And we've got two wonderful guests lined up today. As you know, Ellen and I go around all over Brevard and elsewhere, and I try to communicate with people about the show, and I learn from the events that I attend about everything under the sun. And so I met this wonderful lady, Angelica Harris. She came here in Melbourne to speak at the American Italian Club to speak about her book, The Titanic. The Brothers Perachio. I want to say, Drew, how do you say that word?
Perachio. I would say you're correct. Perachio.
Okay. Perachio. And her book, I heard her speak live about these two boys and a dream. They were her uncles, and she was trying to talk about them and let us know that on the Titanic, when it collided with the iceberg, that these two young kids died. And of course, we always hear about the rich people on the Titanic. We never hear about the people, the wait staff, the janitors, and things like that. And so she wrote a book about that. So she'll be calling in to talk a little bit about that in a minute. And then our second segment, our really good friend, Drew Warren, is here. And Drew is the CEO of Community of Hope. He is also an author, and he just finished writing a book. I want to say it's like Divine Intervention about Pontius Pilate, which, you know, I read the book until 2 a.m. It is a page turner. I don't think anybody would put that book down, because the more you read it, the more you want to learn about that time period and what happened to Lord Jesus Christ. And so Drew, we'll have Drew introduce himself a little bit and chat with us a little bit about what he does while we wait for our guests to call in.
It's good to have you.
Well, yeah. Thank you. It's always good to be here. I love coming in and chatting with you guys. Usually I'm here representing Community of Hope, and honestly, I can't go anywhere and not do that. So I'm here representing Community of Hope as well. Community of Hope does housing, various forms of housing for people coming out of homelessness.
And so with all of that work that you're doing, finding time to write a book was probably a little challenging as well.
Yes, but I felt like I was commanded to do it. So yeah. when I had that little whisper in my ear that says, you'll find time to do this, I found the time.
So while we wait for Miss Angelica Harris to call in, tell our listeners a little bit about what Community of Hope does and what's your role there, because we can certainly use, you know, what you're doing with transitional housing and helping the homeless and all that, and then we'll go into the book.
Yep. So Community of Hope has been around for 20 plus years, and that's what we do is transitional housing, but we also have home ownership opportunities and shelter. So all kinds of
good
all
stuff.
Kinds of things, 500 families a year.
So. You're certainly doing your part on planet Earth, Drew. You're certainly on. We are grateful that you are a friend of our show.
Thank you very much.
I think we've finally got Angelica Harris on the phone. Angelica, thank you so much for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, we're fine. Everybody here, we're grateful that you were able to get in. I think you're calling from your line, right?
Well, my landline was giving me a business signal, so I chose to my cell and it worked. So I'm here. Hi.
Well, listen, anyway. I want to know, where do you get time to do all the things you do? After reading your book, I'm like, okay, she opened her hairdressing salon. You have your own business. You're helping children who are disabled. You are an author of so many books. You've got a husband that you have to take care of that also has, and you're not shy to tell us in your book about the ailments of your children, your husband, and what you're doing. So bring us up to speed. Give us a little background about yourself or for listeners here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words about that. Yes, well, the other thing too is one thing I'm most proud of, I'll go a little backwards, is in 2023, I graduated magna cum laude in personal norm from Fordham University with my Bachelor of Arts. I never received, when I was in college the first time around, I was in Hunter College when I was a young girl, and my father took seriously ill, and it's funny, the salary I was using to pay for my college degree was more money than my mother was making at the time. So I ended up pulling out of college to actually make sure that the bills were paid, and I never went back. I ended up meeting my husband. I got married, had children, and in between, well, before I met my husband, I ended up becoming a hairdresser and makeup artist. And as time moved forward, after I bought my house here in Glendale, I bought my own business and kept that for a while. But then when my husband and my son's ailments started getting worse, I found that working and trying to take care of them were just, you know, a lose-lose situation. And, you know, I believe that you could either serve God or man, and I had to serve God and take care of them. And, I mean, thank God my husband is going on 72 next month. He's doing very well, you know, now. My son is, with all that he went through with Tourette's syndrome and ADHD and all his other learning disabilities, has become, you know, he's a professional chef. So I'm very proud of him. And my daughter works too. So
yeah. Well, and are you calling in from New York?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I live here in Glendale, Queens.
How's the weather there with the snow?
The weather is horribly cold.
Oh my! Well, we wish you were here with us, but I have relatives up there too, and we've been following the storms, you know. But
everybody was home all weekend, though. That got a hold of everybody.
If I were there with you, I would sit down and have a cup of hot chocolate with whipped cream on it, my friend. But listen, the more I read about you, the more you make me want to go back to the Titanic exhibit in Orlando. And this time when I go, I could say in my mind, I actually know someone who loves the Titanic, breathes the Titanic, knows about the Titanic, and knows exactly what happened on April 14, 1912. So tell our listeners here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, you started this journey in high school, I understand.
Yes, I did. I was 17, and it was the beginning of my high school senior year. And we had, since I was planning on going into my Bachelor of Arts degree, and I was planning on studying history and English, my three-year group for study was more medieval history in high school. And I had studied King Arthur and the Round Table, and that was going to be my exit project for my graduation, or I should say, in those days, in my high school, they called it an exit project. But in college, they would call it a thesis project. But then I read about the Titanic in school. We had learned about that in modern history. And I just fell in love with her. It was like her windsulf wrapped herself around my neck and said, Ange, why don't we do a paper on Titanic instead of King Arthur? And my teacher, Mr. Chahala, said, oh, no, you are already committed. The principal of the school is already waiting for your paper for graduation. You can't change it now. It's too late. So I said to him, well, I really want to write about Titanic. He said, well, Ange, you got this choice. You write about both of them. I went, what? So my senior year of high school, I ended up finishing my research on King Arthur and then writing a shorter thesis on Titanic. And but you know, the research on King Arthur was much easier to find than Titanic, because King Arthur is very old world history.
Yes.
You know, you could go into the history books and into encyclopedias and find much about King Arthur and the Round Table, but you can't find much about Titanic, at least back then. I mean, I'm talking about 1974-75. It was considered new history. So I ended up in the New York Donnell Library. I ended up in the New York Library at Bryant Park, taking out books, but I couldn't bring them home. I had to sit there and copy in longhand all the information I needed to write my thesis. And then back then, you know, we didn't just have the computers that we have today. We had microfiche, which was this really small
computer.
We could
just see you in that library just copying things down and making your own drawings and things.
That's the only thing I could do. And so I took this information down and I came back and I wrote it all out on loose leaf paper because I didn't have a computer or a typewriter or anything. I wrote it out all longhand. And I'll never forget, my teacher said to me, okay, there's one thing missing out of all this research. I said, what is that? He said, I need the, he said, what I need from you is the passenger and the crew list. And I looked at him and I said, you're talking about over 2,000 people. I said, how am I going to get that? He said, simple. You're going to write it all out. So I think I went to the library 3 weekends in a row and made sure that my handwriting was so perfect because I was not writing 3,000 names again. And I sat there and I wrote every single name on the on that. And I ended up completing the week before my graduation my exit project on King Arthur and my exit project on Titanic. And
so you are a Titanic historian, and it took you 40 years to write the book. But the book, for our listeners who are tuning into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends and are listening to Angelica Harris, your book is just by coincidence, you met your husband who had an uncle, Uncle Mo, Zio Mo, who Zio Mo had his two brothers, Sebastiano and Alberto. And I know we only have like, what, maybe 15 minutes left of the segment. And I want to get this through to our listeners that you met your husband whose uncle had these two brothers that boarded that Titanic to work in that kitchen and take it from there.
Well, they worked. It's weird because I'll never forget the day I was 19, a little over 19 when I met my husband. And when we went to his Uncle Modesto's house, I met his Uncle Modesto and him and his Aunt Angela for the very first time. And we were getting serious as boyfriend and girlfriend. And I'll never forget, ZMO was a chef himself. He worked on the Olympic, the Titanic sister ship. And he also worked, he was a head chef at Sardi's in Manhattan for many, many years. And anyway, to make this story short, after dinner, we went into the family room. And into the family room, there was this picture of the Titanic with two cameo pictures of two young men. One was Alberto, one was Sebastiano. And I looked at the picture of Titanic, and all I said to myself under my breath was Titanic. And Ziomo, who I was calling Mr. Paracchio at the time, he said, what do you know about the ship? Did you have anybody on the ship? I said, no, I studied her in history. He said, wait a minute, you're a history student? I said, and he said all this in his Italian accent. And I said to him,
I could just see that scene, you know, like my mind as I read that, I could see you, a beautiful young girl comes over and this Italian guy walks over and he goes, I want you to find these people.
Well, that's exactly what happened. He says to me, I need you to help me find my brothers. And I said, but I'm not family.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even his wife. He's my boyfriend. And he said to me, he looked, mind you, these two Italian people who were in my age bracket now looked at the both of us. And I'll never forget ZMO telling me, you call me ZMO from now on. I'm ZMO. I'm not Mr. Paracchio.
I knew you were going to marry John at that point.
Right. He looked at me and he said, the way you two look at each other, I see a ring on the finger, maybe a year from now.
Yeah.
And I went, what? And he made me blush, but, you know, he knew more than we did. You know, sometimes the old know more than the young. So when he started telling me about his brothers, all I know is I said, your brothers were really on the ship. And it was like, you know, here I was 2 years ago in high school studying about this ship and the, you know, the glorification that history made of her, like, you know, this heroic worship of this ship. But now it's real. Wait a minute. These two boys, these two young men were on the ship? Really? And what happened? He said, I don't know what happened to my brothers. All I know is they were never found. We don't know what could have happened to them. I need your help. And that was it.
Yes.
I'm looking at the time myself.
Yes.
And that was it. From that time on, I ended up not only, you know, and unfortunately, I ended up dropping out of college, like I said, because of my father. But then from that time on, I was dedicating myself to, you know, going to work, studying, and whenever I had 5 minutes or 10 minutes, I'd go into a library, see what I could find about Titanic, ask family. And of course, you know, my husband's family weren't ready to give me information because they kept telling me, you're not part of this family yet. You're not anybody. Mind your own business. But I didn't, you know, I wasn't part of the family, Cedar. I was nobody at the time. I was just my husband's girlfriend.
Yes.
And or they get mad at CMO. Why are you asking a stranger for information? But, you know, he'd say, because she knows what she's doing. And when I would go there for dinner, which was often, she would ask me, what did you find? What did you this? You know, and I dare him. And having a glass of wine and helping him out in the kitchen, because I love to cook just as much as he did. And we would talk about his brothers and where they lived in Fubini, Alessandria, how they, you know, worked with their father on the ships, how they worked in the ship's docks, where, how they went to school only on the weekends. I mean, these were kids from, you know, these kids weren't rich. They had to work. I mean, you know, and then, but then to go forward, after a while, I joined Facebook. Modern era comes in. We have all computers. We have Facebook. And I joined Titanic Societies. And after I joined the Titanic Society of Atlantic Canada, I met Deanna Rollmeister and her husband, Neil Meister. And we started talking and chatting and then talking on the phone about Halifax and how closely related it is to the Titanic, and then how maybe she could help me with research. And before you know it, my notes, my 40 years worth of notes were becoming a book. And
right.
Started off as
led you to the owner, Luigi, and then you were able to find the list. You traveled here to Winter Park. You traveled to Canada. You traveled all over the country where there was things happening about the Titanic and historians who were doing, who were also speaking about it. So really quick, tell our listeners how you found the boys' names, because they were not passengers. And the beginning, Uncle Mo could not give you that information either. And he died before the book was published. So in his memory, right. You really found those boys, his brothers. He was 4 years old when they left. So we have a few minutes left. Tell us quickly how you found their names.
I found their names. I'll never forget. I had gone to the museum exhibition, and their names were on the wall. And I also found their names through the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic, when I called Richard McMichael, and one of the reasons why I couldn't find them was because their names were misspelled so many times in the history books that I was able to finally give them the correct spelling, and they alerted the museums. But to give you, I know we have 2 minutes left for this conversation.
We'll give you our ads time, because it's such an interesting topic.
So, but right now, it wasn't just, right now I'm very, very happy. I'm going to write the sequel to the book. I'm writing about, they were held back on the ship by the stewards of the Titanic. And unfortunately, because they were held back, they couldn't save their own lives. And that's how they died on the Titanic.
Yeah, well, I think they told them to stay in their cabins. They were actually, like, locked in their cabins, if you ask me. All the people that worked in the restaurant, they locked them in there, and they said, we will let you know when you can come out. So they all died in the same spot.
Right, but by then it was too late. And I am writing the sequel to that next book using the British and the American inquiry of how the boys died on the ship, and through the testimony of people who were actually witnesses to how it happened, who were able to survive.
Yeah.
And then also I'm very proud that the Pigeon Forge Museum in Tennessee is going to be doing a display of my uncle's. So I'll be going out there sooner or later for the opening of the display.
Yeah, and you are giving speeches all over the country, and and I think, you know, your books sort of makes me feel like, you know, in our nation today, the rich, the famous, the people who have the loudest voices, they get all the attention. People hear about them. They love hearing about them. And the ones who don't have a voice, no one knows their story. So you bringing life to the Perocchio brothers is really for us. You hit a home run with that for me, because whenever we hear about the Titanic and we hear that it sunk and it cost 1.5 million pounds to build and the debts and the boats and all that, no one talks about the people who were cleaning that boat, cooking on that boat and all that. And so you brought that to life. How is it received when you give your speeches all over the country?
Most people are very happy. See, we're middle class people. If you want, you could call my uncle. If they were in America, they would be, in those days, they would be known as the lower third class people. And I mean, excuse me. Plus, they were coming here to America with Luigi Gatti in hopes of opening up another culinary school, because he had two schools, one in England, one in France. He was hoping to open up a third one here in America. They were looking for a better life, to come to America to bring their family, and they were immigrants. The thing is, you know, because of the immigration process, because they were not considered American or white or anything like that, they were held back. This is why, you know, stories like this, people in history or the rich or politicians don't want these stories told, because these are the true tales of people who worked hard, not like the rich people who put money in their pocket all the time. These are people who had to work hard to make their countries great, to feed their families,
we all know that that America is a land of immigrants, and that's why a lot of us nowadays, when we see what's happening with immigrants, we have a heart. We feel for them, because we know that everybody was coming here. There are so many root causes why people flee, but you're right. Coming for a better life was one. And really quick, I read in your book, a little part of it, that there was a lifeboat drill that was scheduled for April 14th, the same day the ship went down, and that never happened.
No, it didn't. It didn't. That was the other thing. The controversies were so much. See, now Glenn, Titanic, as much as she was beautiful, and if you want to call her royal, she was also neglected. I'm going to say this. She was neglected. She shouldn't have gone out without all her faculties in order, meaning without her flares, without her glasses. What are they called? Binoculars. Without anything. She needed everything ready. She wasn't properly dressed for it. She needed extra lifeboats. Oh, it's going to cause too much clutter for the first class passengers. Again, the first class passengers. What about the other people?
Yes.
There's 3,000 people. There were 2,040 people, over 2,040 people on that ship. You're telling me that 20 lifeboats are going to hold all those people? They're not.
Well, they said the estimated wealth of the people in first class were 500 million. So you're right. They wanted to appease those people. The ship had to look a certain way. They had to be dressed a certain way. They had to eat a certain way. You know, it was like class warfare, you know?
So, Angie, where can we find your book, and where can we get a hold of you to find out about your speaking engagements?
Well, right now, I don't have anything in the works for speaking. A lot of it, too, is holding back. I'm the youth ministry coordinator in my parish, and I work with a lot of children. I love it. I love my kids. But right now, in the winter, I usually don't take too many.
So where can we find your book? Where can we purchase the book?
Anyone could find it on Amazon.
Okay.
You could also, if anybody wants to order my book personally, they could email me at angelicaharris57@gmail.com. Put Titanic book on the
subject line.
The subject, and they could, you know, they could order a book personally from me, and I'll sign it. Basically, it's on Amazon. They can get it.
We'll make sure we share all of this great information, and thank you so much for writing this book. I actually was in Nova Scotia and was at the Titanic, cemetery. So there's a lot of great history as it relates to that as well. We'll make sure we get all the information out. We're going to take a quick, brief break and listen to our sponsors. We'll be right back with Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right after these messages.
Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at Cloud9, that's Cloud9Furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads. 321-268-5000. 321-268-5000. Or visit them on the web at DixieCrossroads.com. Jotkoff Financial Group is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships with clients. Jotkoff Financial Group can assist you in meeting your accounting, tax, and business consulting and financial planning and insurance needs without expanding your internal workforce. With 3 locations here in Florida, here in Brevard County, Broward County, and Nassau County, contact Jotkoff Financial Group here in Brevard at 321-984-7345, located at 1122 South Wickham Road in Melbourne. That's Jotkoff Financial Group. On the web, you'll find them at www.jotkoff.com. Call the professionals at Jotkoff Financial Group today.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in sunny Cocoa, Florida. I feel bad saying that after knowing what's going on up north.
I know. Well,
we are heard on AM 1510, WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, online, everywhere,
It's 1510 WWBC. You can hit that listen live button and get us on any one of your streaming devices. Of course, we share all of that information on our website as well as all the social media channels, cedamediainc.com.
Yeah. And that was a very good first segment. I've always been interested in the Titanic. Of course, who would forget Rose, you know, and what was his name?
Rose? Oh, Jack.
Jack, yes. Rose and Jack, which was a fictional story, but it was really nice.
But the cool part is when you go to Nova Scotia, that's a big part of Halifax. The city of Halifax is the, because they were the ones that responded apparently first right. to the
Well, I mean, to transition from cool. the Titanic to what Drew wrote, I feel like Drew had a dream from Jesus himself to write this book. So my friend Drew Warren is here. He is also the CEO of Community of Hope here in Brevard County, Florida. And I was thrilled that I found my book that he gave me. The book is called I Wash My Hands, the autobiography of Pontius Pilate. Mm-hmm. And Drew Warren, what a read. I don't think this girl, Sita Biggie, could put this book down. So talk to our listeners here about why you decided to write a book about the man who a lot of people believe is responsible for the death of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it was it's interesting. I actually had a moment when I was sitting there. I know you know that I do work with my primary job is working with families coming out of homelessness and helping them navigate their way into stability. And if anybody does that kind of work, you'll know it's frustrating. And I had a moment where I thought to myself, boy, I just want to wash my hands of this situation. And in that moment, I felt like a different voice came into my head and said, that's your book. You need to write that. And within 15 minutes, I had the entire outline of the book written out.
You were compelled to write this book.
Absolutely compelled. I had no choice.
Something was pulling you. Like, so, I mean, I grew up in the islands in Trinidad and Tobago, and our country was founded on the Christian faith, and subsequently we have other faiths there as well. And I didn't learn as much about Pontius Pilate as I read in the book. So what is it about him drew you to that character? Because around that time, you had all the disciples.
Yep.
And you had the priests in the temples, and you had all the different emperors. And it is maddening how when one died, they had somebody waiting, and there was a lot of brutality and a lot of murders and a lot of dramas so people won't ascend to royalty or become an emperor. But then you picked Pontius Pilate.
Yeah, and I think it's because he really, first of all, there's not a whole lot known about his life. There are several different sources and different things that are known. But otherwise, much of his life, you could say, applies to any of us. We are all caught in those terrible situations where we're pulled by one side, pulled by another, the forces of the world acting on us, and we feel like we don't have control because we don't. And that's an important part of this book, is it's all about him recognizing that there were situations that he could not control. But just because he couldn't control them didn't mean he didn't have responsibility.
That's right. And he did. I know as I read the book, you're so right, because sometimes we see political pundits on television or cable news or on social media, and you wonder why certain people say certain things when you know it's not right. And I say, oh, they have mortgages, they have car payment, they have health insurance, they've got to live. In his case, he wanted to please the people.
Yeah. So he was caught between the Roman emperor, and he does actually know that there's plenty of historical evidence that he was well acquainted with Emperor Tiberius or Caesar Tiberius at the time. But he's caught between that power structure of Rome and the power structure in Jerusalem at the time, which was the priests of the temple. Particularly Caiaphas. And so he's stuck in a situation where he's kind of being played by both sides. And I think in today's world, we can kind of see that there are powers kind of pulling us one direction or another. Our job is to kind of try to navigate
that. To cipher it out. So well, Pontius Pilate.
The challenge with that is, too, is that some people thought he was a martyr,
mm-hmm.
and some people thought that he was this brutal figure. So same person, same, and again, it goes back to perspective of how we see things.
Right. And, you know, the Bible shows us that Pontius Pilate was a man caught between politics, mm-hmm. truth, and fear.
Mm-hmm.
He was very fearful for his life. So on so many occasions in your book, yeah. you talk about all his friends and the way they killed him. Either crucifixion, they just cut their heads off.
Yeah, if you look at the history of the Roman Empire, and particularly the time of Tiberius, and some of the things that were going on, people were being executed all over the place at that point because Tiberius was very paranoid. He had a second in command.
He had mental illness.
He did.
The whole family had mental illness.
Yes. Yes. And then you add to that the power dynamics of Rome, and you had Sejanus, who was trying to kind of take the place of the emperor.
And he ended up getting killed too.
And that is correct. Yeah. And all the friends of Sejanus, including Pontius Pilate, who was selected for this role by Sejanus, were in danger of being executed.
Right. And so all these people are the descendants of Caesar.
Yeah. So Caesar,
how do you remember all these people's names
that
like
is,
that?
That is a challenge.
You rattle off Tiberius.
That is a challenge because not only is it all the people, but it's all the interrelationships among the people. For example, everyone remembers Caligula because he was such a salacious character as the emperor of Rome. But Caligula was the nephew of Tiberius, who was then selected to be Tiberius's, take over after Tiberius. But the interconnections of Tiberius and Caligula and the entire family, in fact, Pontius Pilate, most people think, was married to Claudia, and
they think she was part of that family,
and
too.
She was a part of that family as well. So there's a lot of knowledge, a lot of connections to keep track of, but the bottom line is, here's this guy kind of caught in this web. And trying to make his way out. And unfortunately, he comes across Jesus at the time. And Jesus becomes, kind of this, to coin a phrase, or to use the phrase, a sacrificial lamb of the empire. And Pontius is caught in the situation of having to do that. And I think if you look through at the rest of the story, the first half is growing up in the Roman Empire and what that would have been like for someone growing up as Pontius did, why he thought the way he thought. But then the second half of the story is being introduced to the Jewish thinking of the time, to the to what grew into Christianity,
so
to
thinking,
Christ himself.
The
yes.
thinking at that time, everything was relative to what was happening on the ground. And Pontius Pilate, he... his main duties as the Roman prefect, the governor, he had to maintain law and order.
Correct.
So the book, I mean, you started, you know, as I started reading the book, we're introduced to the relatives of all these people, Sejanus and I forgot, how do you say it?
Tiberius.
And then you're watching that if they didn't like a certain nephew or niece, that person got killed. If they didn't want that person to ascend to the throne or whatever, right? But then at the same time, you watch Pontius Pilate that knew some of these people from childhood, and he knew the demons that they had for whatever reason, being raised without parents, being raised by themselves. The guy was 12 years old when he saw killing one of the people. I forgot his name.
Yes. So he certainly knew all these people and it was definitely he was, again, kind of like we mentioned with the previous Angelica Harris in the previous book we were talking about. I think he was put in the place and time he needed to be put. I don't think anybody else could have been in his position and us have Christianity in its current form without that person. So whether you agree with what he did or don't agree with what he did, I think he was perfectly placed in that
role. Yeah, because when they brought Jesus to him, and I started imagining this scene as I read the book, and he looked in his eyes, he saw something in his eyes. But then you talk about later on in the book when he was bloodied, he was beaten. It was a brutal way to kill someone, to murder. I think they murdered him. And then they put him on the cross, and you talk about him going up that hill, and Jesus still had some life in him, but the executioners wanted to make sure he was still alive when they nailed him to the cross. It's almost like, God forbid, if he had died carrying the cross, they would have been upset because they wanted to crucify him. And that just broke me. I'm like, so if the guy, if Jesus was already in that, he was bleeding, blood was coming out of everywhere, and he is dying carrying this big heavy cross, and you don't want him to die because you want the people to see what happens to him.
Mm-hmm.
That just broke me.
And in fact, having someone else carry the cross for him was in large part because of that. It was not just because the person, and I've read a book about the individual who has carried the cross as well. I think you might enjoy that book, but that person carried the cross in part to alleviate the Jesus who could not carry it any longer, but also to make sure Jesus could get to the top of that hill,
right,
and face crucifixion.
And I read where Pontius Pilate said that he did not find any fault in Jesus, that he did not really have a cause to put him to death. And then the people were banging on that door. There were hundreds of them outside wanting him to crucify this man. And yes, it's almost like the similarities of our world today with hate and greed and riches and
the civil war that Rome was going through.
Yeah, I mean,
at the time,
you could
just
see those angry people at Pontius Pilate's front door, and Pontius Pilate just had that really one good friend that stayed with him right until the end, and he was there with him.
Yes.
So take us to that moment, that scene, as you were writing that scene when they brought Jesus to him, and he asked the people, should they take the crooked guy? I want to say Barnabas, but it's Barabbas. And they choose to let the crooked man go and crucify Jesus.
Yep. So I think Pontius Pilate did everything he knew to do to prevent Jesus from being crucified, including the offering Barabbas as a substitute. And the crowd would not have it, but the crowd was being stirred by Caiaphas and the temple priests. They owed everything to the temple priests, and the temple priests controlled them. Their life was in large part controlled by the temple priests. And so
who were greedy.
They
just wanted money and riches and taxes.
But those weren't the Jewish people. And that's important.
Right.
That's an important
distinction.
It was the priest.
It was one man.
It was the powerful priests of the temple who made their money and had their power by manipulating the people. And so you know, there's been this ongoing debate: did Romans kill Jesus? Did the Jewish people kill Jesus? No, the people in seats of power who didn't want to give up power killed Jesus. And to this day, I think every day that we're still killing Jesus, we're doing the same battles over and over through our history.
Right. And you do get the sense that he did die to save the world as you finish your book, right? But I want to say that Pilate did try to avoid condemning Jesus, and he tried to pass that responsibility on to King Herod. So tell us, why didn't King Herod offer to release Jesus? Instead, he talked about Passover, and the crowd demanded that they take care of it right then.
Yeah, that's a good question, and honestly, it goes to the fact that the King Herod we think about in this story is not the original King Herod. The original King Herod was alive at the time of Jesus' birth. So there's this family dynamic, and those family dynamics really kept King Herod Antipas, who was the Herod of the at the time of the crucifixion, kind of wanted to make sure he wanted to wash his hands of it too, make sure he wanted to stay clean of the situation and not have the blood on his hands.
Yeah. And but one thing about Jesus, he was not afraid.
No.
He was not afraid. And then he, even though he was taking his last few breaths, he started talking in the end. And he told everybody what he was preaching, I think, over the times.
Yeah, and if you look at what Jesus said on the cross, it was a throwback to things that were said in by prophets hundreds of years before. And so he was telling people that he was fulfilling the prophecy in his very last words. And he knew in going to the cross, he knew that he was going to be crucified. He knew what was going to happen, and yet he did it anyway. And I think that's the look you mentioned earlier to Pilate, that he kind of looked at Pilate with a look of forgiveness, because he understood that this was a path that he had to take, and that Pilate wasn't sending him on that path. It was his path to walk.
In my, you know, of course, this, your book talks a lot about dreams, and Pilate's wife, mm-hmm. she had dreams about
yes.
Jesus and what was going to happen. But you're right. Pilate himself, Pontius Pilate, was afraid of the crowd, but Jesus wasn't.
No.
Because Pilate, and I think they said, this is where that phrase, I wash my hands, or I wash my hands of something, that Pilate tried to show he wasn't responsible for Jesus's death. And that's where the modern phrase, I wash my hands of it. But he was literally scared to death of the crowd. And Jesus said he wasn't. Do you have a contrast with these two men?
Well, I think at the time, and I think if you read the rest of the book over the next few chapters, you really see that moment was a change for Pilate as well. That was a wake up call for Pilate as well, and I think I mentioned earlier, I think in a separate conversation, that we all kind of go through life battling the kind of powers that be in the world that are sometimes not all that holy, trying to find something sacred. And I think in that moment in time, Pontius Pilate saw something sacred and it changed him.
Right. Well, at that point, he started understanding what truth really is. That's what it was.
That is correct.
Yeah, he understood what truth was. And he knew at that moment what he had done was not the right thing, but he just couldn't help himself.
Well, he was weak, and he, like, you know, I didn't read the book, but I know the story. He was not the strongest leader from a strength or an inner strength perspective. He really was kind of following the crowd and following what the crowd wanted, and that was the dichotomy of the challenge of the people in power versus the people of the streets, right?
Right.
But making sure that he was trying to do the right thing.
Right. And, you know, above Jesus's head, they, you know, I saw this as a little child in a lot of plays and things they would have. Above his head, they would have the King of the Jews, mm-hmm. and they would say Jesus of Nazareth. And, right, the crown of the thorns. And the chief priests wanted a change, but Pilate refused. Because he believed he was the king, more so than the people who were on the ground, who were making all these decisions for other people, the rich and the powerful.
Yeah.
It was a different kind of king, king.
And I think you mentioned that Pilate was, you know, kind of weak. And I think up to that point in time, he was certainly, I don't know if I would say weak, but certainly caught between the forces and trying to navigate them and make everyone happy and keep his head. And more importantly, I think he was trying to keep Claudia safe and prevent any negative blowback on her. But I think in that moment, he realized that sacred, that is so much more important. And I think that's what gave him strength for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Now, his wife played a a pivotal role in your book.
Yes.
And in his life, Pontius Pilate's life, Claudia. So Claudia was actually, she accepted Jesus Christ as her Lord and Savior before almost everybody else did.
So there is a debate throughout history and Christianity of what happened with Claudia, what happened with Pilate. But there are people who, there are factions of Christian faith who believe that Claudia was a saint. There are even those who believe that Pontius Pilate himself became a saint. There's reference to Claudia in the New Testament, but not, they don't mention which Claudia it was. And so there's talk about maybe this this Claudia who's mentioned in the Gospels, or not in the Gospels, but in later letters by Paul, was also the Claudia, but there's no one's ever been able to prove one way or the other. But yes, I believe Claudia definitely pushed Pontius toward a life of faith. Yes.
Do you see any similarities between today's world and the events that are happening now and the historical events that happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we're all caught in the middle. I think we're all Pontius Pilate in a sense that we're every man. And every woman caught in the middle and being manipulated by forces beyond us. And we all have to wake up and we all have to see those forces for what they are and say, I'm going to walk the right path, not just get pulled one direction or another.
Right. And there were so many powerful figures that Pontius Pilate had to interact with.
Yes.
And he really had an ability to see through all these people. He knew right from wrong from the get-go, I think.
I think so, too. And I think over time, especially after his encounter with Jesus, he had a very strong wake-up call. And I think that really patterned the rest of his life. If I could, there was a moment where he was recalled to Rome, likely to face his own execution at the hands of Tiberius. And at that moment, the night before facing a judgment by Tiberius, Tiberius died.
Yes.
And instead of facing Tiberius, he faced Caligula. And Caligula said, I don't know anything about this. You can go be free.
Yeah.
And that moment of, I think, and that was a historically happened. I think that moment really
was divine intervention.
Divine intervention.
I read.
Well, it's all chosen, right? Yeah. You were chosen to write this book.
I believe, right?
And we were, and it, even back in history, people are over and over again speak about being chosen. And this was the path, as tough as it was, this was the path they were supposed to take.
Well, being in the right place at the right time and getting the divine intervention. Would you say the book is fiction or history?
I would actually say it's mostly historical. I do. There's a lot of fictional aspects to it in terms of whether or not Pontius Pilate was in a particular place in time during that part of history. However, for example, was he there when Caligula was assassinated? I don't know. There's no
proof. But I like that plot.
There's no proof one way or the other.
I like the plot, and I'm not one to like murdering, but they did it the right way.
They did it well. But I think Caligula was assassinated, and whether Pontius was there or not, it plays well into the story of Pontius Pilate, the history of the world, and the growth of Christianity.
And I admired that his friend stepped forward and saved the other five, but he ended up getting executed. Yes. I felt sorry for his wife and children after that, too. But anyways, Drew Warren, this book is fascinating, and it's really a great read, and it's worth dissecting, like, every chapter. I think if you had a book club discussion about it, it would take, like, a whole year. So tell us about where we can find a book, because we have to go off in a minute.
It is on Amazon, both Kindle and in hard copy. It is also on Barnes & Noble and Google Books. It's also available on my website, pdrewwarren.com.
We will make sure we share all that great information. And what great stories today. They're really, really great stories. I Wash My Hands by Drew Warren. Make sure you check that book out. We will make sure that all of this information is posted. You'll be able to get the downloads very quickly. And thanks again for tuning in and supporting Viewpoint with CDEM Friends here on Community Radio 1510 WWBC.